Chapter 19. Isle of Serenity. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green, and was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? William Blake. A whirlwind transported me into a new and wondrous world of genteel, traditional England, one far removed from the blue-collar air of Manchester and London's international atmosphere. Our fast commuter train from Waterloo surged out of London like a racehorse at the starting gate. It left behind the great pollution-engulfed metropolis, overtook local trains, rattled swiftly through the iconic Clapham Junction, rushed across the green Hampshire countryside, the hedgerows and meadows, past old garden communities, hamlets and villages, stopping finally at the affluent conservative stockbroker enclaves of Woking, Guildford, Hazelmere and Petersfield. Men in suits and bowler hats, with rolled umbrellas and briefcases, disembarked to idling rovers filled with young families that waited to bring them home for drinks and dinner. They had managed, or speculated with, or made millions in the city on the stock exchange. The train dashed on through Britannia's Surrey countryside. Jerusalem, the hymn we sang during assembly in Manchester, singing of England's mountains green and pleasant pastures, rang true. My week of accumulated tensions ebbed exponentially with our progressive distancing from London. My headmaster's image appeared in the ferry window, angrily mouthing, "Liverpool Medical School." This was the other England, the one I longed to know. Victoria, sitting opposite me in a summer suit and sensible one-inch heels, belonged to this scene. When we stopped at Hazelmere, she told me that her grandmother, Dagmar, from New Zealand, lived there in an old shepherd's cottage, while her aunt Bunt lived in nearby Petersfield. I liked the idea that I might become part of an established British family and wished I had thought to buy flowers for her mother. The train briefly stopped in Havant and Portsmouth before finally rolling into Portsmouth Harbour. When the last passengers rushed on board, the ferry pushed off into the Solent, sailing past Royal Navy ships and submarine bases, heading to Ryde on the Isle of Wight, Tranquility's base. When we disembarked, Victoria's mother and brother, Tim, met us at the head of the pier. There was no mistaking Shirley. She looked just like her daughter, with coiffed hair fluttering in the sea breeze and a slight middle-age spread. "Darling, it's wonderful to see you." There were smiles all around, no kisses, no hugs. "You look well. This must be Mawan. Is that how you pronounce it? I was in Egypt years ago." "It's Marwan, a difficult name." She told me to call her Shirley and immediately shared the neighbourhood news. "Darling, did you know?" and "Darling, have you heard?" tumbled out of her mouth with the latest gossip, lush with innuendo and scandal. She announced that Tim, home from public school, was taking driving lessons. Tim was a gangly, handsome 17-year-old, polite and quiet, with rapidly surveying eyes. Sitting in the front passenger seat, he picked his pimples in the rear-view mirror. I sat in the back with Shirley, absorbing the wonderfully comfortable family environment. In the late daylight, Victoria pointed out various landmarks as she drove the 20 minutes along the coastal road to the village of Seaview. They lived in a semi-detached house, one street from the rolling swell of the Solent. Victoria took my bag up to the front guest bedroom and then showed me her room, Tim's and Shirley's. She was happy and radiant, beautiful in a red print dress. She gave me a kiss, more like a peck on the cheek. We continued into the front drawing room. "Would you like a drink?" Shirley asked. "No, thanks, I don't really drink." "A glass of sherry, a gin and tonic. Vicky is having one." "A gin and tonic would be fine, thank you." "Well, make it yourself, dear boy. I have to go to the kitchen to check on dinner." Turning to Victoria, she said, "Dinner at 8, darling. We're having leg of lamb, your favourite, darling, and I made a pavlova for dessert. Darling, do change for dinner," she added, disappearing into the kitchen. At dinner, I wore a shirt, tie and jacket, which I had never worn to dine in Commonwealth Hall's refectory. Victoria opened a bottle of wine, and Shirley carved the leg of lamb. She was a good cook. The lamb, with roasted potatoes and parsnips, was excellent, but the raspberry pavlova was exquisite. Throughout dinner, Shirley monopolized the conversation, chatting enthusiastically about Trevor. How she had gone up to London to be with him, how he might come to the island for a weekend, and so on. This raised questions of when and for how long from one or the other of her children. The response was always vague. Realizing that I did not know the name, Victoria leaned over when Shirley stepped into the kitchen and said, "Trevor is her on-again, off-again boyfriend." It seemed that my presence had prompted a competition between the two women. Shirley refused my offer of help to clean up, encouraging us to take a walk as the early autumn darkness was creeping in. The sea breeze was refreshing. A light fog was rolling in from the west. Waves crashed against the sea wall, occasionally spraying us as we walked along the narrow path, holding hands. I began to breathe deeply. "I had to make up your bed and get you some towels. Mummy is hopeless when she's this high." "What do you mean?" "She's manic depressive and on all sorts of medicines. She sees a psychiatrist in London who claims it's a chemical imbalance of the brain, not a mental illness. He put her on lithium. She's developed a hand tremor. She shouldn't drink, except she does, because she is so very sociable." This was the first time Victoria had mentioned her mother's ailment, although I had observed the tremor at dinner. I sensed the burden of concern that Victoria was quietly carrying, and I wanted to embrace her, to comfort her, to let her know that I cared for her. "Did she always have this?" I asked, placing my arm around her shoulders. "The psychiatrist thinks it was brought on by the shock of Daddy's sudden death. You know he designed the Princess, the huge flying boat."
"You mean the one Saunders Row built?"
"Yes. And my great-uncle, Elliot Verdon Roe, together with his brother, started the Avro Aircraft Company in the early 20th century. You know, the one that made the big Lancaster bomber in World War II. They later bought a share in the Saunders Marine Company."
"Really? I dreamed of becoming an aeronautical engineer, but I was lousy at math, so I had to follow my other dream of becoming a surgeon. So here I am, a medical student."
"You're better off becoming a surgeon," she said with a smile. I did not ask her why she thought that.
I felt an intense affinity with her and drew her closer as we continued our walk along the sea wall in silence. After a while, she said,
"Daddy worked in London and lived at his club during the week. He came home on Friday evenings. When we were young, Mummy would dress Tim and me in nice clothes to greet him. She would tell us to be nice children, no misbehaving. If she thought I did, she would call me Veruke, a wart. We were sent to bed early so they could be alone. He returned to London on Monday mornings."
"Sounds like you didn't get to see him much as a small child. That must have been tough." She turned toward me, and for a moment I thought she was going to embrace me. Her teary eyes did not elude me in the gathering dusk. I took her hand and we walked on in silence, listening to the crashing waves and tasting the salty spray that showered us from time to time. I wondered if it was painful for Victoria to dredge up stories about her family.
"How old were you when your father died?"
11.
"Really? My father died when I was around that age too, and my mother hasn't been herself since."
"Mummy was told he was on the Queen's New Year's honour list. He was scheduled to become a Knight of the British Empire, Sir Robert Perfect. She would have become Lady Perfect. I learned after his death that Daddy had a previous marriage and had a son. I was shocked to discover I wasn't the oldest child. I did find out that Daddy left that son some money in his will."
"My father told me once that when he and my mother lived in Sudan, they thought of adopting a young boy named Ibrahim. Only in Islam, adoption is difficult."
"You'd have had an older, dark-skinned brother."
"Not only that, but after my sister was born, they might not have wanted another child, and I would not be here," I said. The walk led us to the exclusive Seaview Yacht Club, lit up in the dark like a Christmas tree on a rocky prominence. Sounds of chatter, music and merriment floated across the water. Beyond the stony shore were mermaid yachts, the ones used in club races. Bobbing up and down on the ocean swells in the moonlight, their mast lights twinkled and their rigging clanged rhythmically with each incoming wave. We were both tired and ambled back along the street of semi-detached houses. Passing a house with the drawing-room curtains open, we saw an elderly man pulling a younger woman onto the sofa. According to Shirley's earlier chatter, the widower was causing a scandal by running around with all the women in the village. On our return to the house, we found the dishes still on the dining table and others piled up in the sink. We cleared the table, I stacked the dishwasher, and Victoria cleaned up the kitchen. "Mummy can't manage," was all she said, adding, "It gets worse when she's broody." In the drawing room, Shirley rose from the sofa, leaving on the TV.
"I'm suddenly very tired. I must have nodded off. I'm going to bed."
She looked much older than before.
"Good night. Do tidy up the sofa cushions when you youngsters go to bed. Tim is out, so I'll leave the light on."
She walked somewhat unsteadily, closing the door behind her.
"There's no food in the house. We'll have to drive to the shops in the morning. I'll cook dinner, or we can go for Chinese. Oh, and Mummy arranged to meet friends for drinks at the yacht club at 11. She wants you to meet Mr. Walker, a surgeon on the island. We might lunch at the club, or I'll drive you to the Downs. The view of the sea and the rest of the island to our north is magnificent. On a clear day, we can see the coast of France."
Hesitantly, she said,
"I'm sorry about Mummy. Her moods are unpredictable. She's fine today, but tomorrow she may not get out of bed for a week. I hope the lithium will help."
"Who takes care of her when she takes to bed?"
"Various friends in the village look in on her. Occasionally she has meals on wheels. The nurse across the street telephones me when matters become acute. With my studies, I really have no time to do more for her than worry. Fortunately, our GP knows her well, and one of her friends drives her to see him."
I sensed that Victoria was distancing herself from her mother's illness. I saw no other solution, given the demands of medical school. We kissed and hugged shyly. I felt her body as I rubbed my hand up and down her slim back. We straightened out the sofa cushions, turned off the drawing-room lights, and climbed the steps to the landing in semi-darkness. We hugged once more in the dark. She apologized for the situation again, almost beginning to sob. I held her tightly, hoping she would sense my loyalty and support. My bed was comfortable. Exhausted, I was lulled by the rhythmic sounds of a boy's bell muffled by the thick fog. I slept soundly. In the village where we shopped, the grocer, the butcher, the newspaper seller, and the postmistress all knew Victoria and asked about her studies and Shirley's health. There was worry on her face when they expressed their concern about Shirley. Victoria avoided questions concerning her mother by introducing me. Walking home in the gloriously sunny morning of the late Indian summer, we could see down the sloping streets to the nanny boat that was taking crews out to the mermaids in preparation for a race. This would be a good day to race, since the sea was placid. Victoria shared more stories about how she and Tim had sailed since they were little. The centre of Shirley's social life was the Seaview Yacht Club, festooned with nautical flags, flapping in a steady sea breeze that mitigated the heat of the late summer sunshine. Mr. Walker and Shirley sat on the uncovered deck, nursing drinks. He feigned delight at meeting me. He was of Shirley's generation, dressed in a dark blue pinstriped suit with pale pink tie. I told him about my desire to become a surgeon. As we chatted, I watched the mermaids maneuver into position at the invisible starting line. On top of the chalk cliffs of Culver Downs, the wind blew steadily across the prominent headland. We sat in the car, where we had a spectacular view of the English Channel, sparkling with a thousand points of diamond sunlight. The area was wild, protected, and pristine, with an occasional flock of sheep. Its utter peacefulness was in stark contrast to the hustle and bustle of medical school. I realized I could get used to this. Focusing on Victoria, I fingered her hair and caressed the nape of her neck, telling her I was falling in love with her and thanking her for bringing me to this idyllic place. We returned Monday morning on the first commuter ferry train sliding into Waterloo Station. During our return trip, I was haunted by Shirley's manic depression. Was it hereditary? Would Victoria eventually present with it? I thought about the 9 a.m. pharmacology lecture I gladly missed for the price of tranquility on the Isle of Serenity. My curiosity had been piqued and my sense of mystery enhanced. I wanted to get to know Victoria better and to explore with her the vulnerability of our new relationship. I failed my mid-December pharmacology exam. With that, the chasm separating the college and the hospital widened dangerously. Was I going to make it to become a doctor? Failure put a hot pepper up my rectum, as we did in Egypt to motivate a donkey stubbornly stalled in its path. Like the donkey, who then takes off, it boosted my determination to focus on the subject. I was successful in passing when the makeup exam was given a month later. The distilling of urine that fouled our air finally stopped when the precious white powder turned out to be a mundane compound called nicotine.